a healthy day.
Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. Putin meeting with Kerry. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said he had frank discussions on Ukraine, Syria, and Iran with Russian President Vladimir Putin Tuesday, during Kerry's first visit to Russia since relations soured over sharp disagreements on Ukraine and Syria. Kerry made the comment Tuesday on Twitter and added it's important to keep lines of communication between the U.S. and Russia open as we address pressing global issues. Before sitting down with Mr. Putin in the resort city of Sochi, Kerry met Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov for more than 4 hours in what is the highest-level U.S. visit to Russia since the Ukraine crisis began. The U.S. State Department said Kerry and Putin would discuss a full range of bilateral and regional issues, including Yemen and Libya, as part of an ongoing effort to ensure that the U.S. views are clearly conveyed. Masked assailants armed with machetes killed a blogger Tuesday in northeastern Bangladesh, police said, in the third such attack this year against a secular writer in the mostly Muslim country. Authorities said the attackers killed Ananta Bijoy Das. They did not identify any suspects or motive. Das wrote for a website called Mukto Mona, which was formerly run by prominent Bangladeshi-American blogger Avjit Roy. In late February, Roy, who was known for writing in opposition to religious fundamentalism, was killed after leaving a book fair with his wife at Dhaka University. Authorities arrested a suspect in Roy's killing. This is VOA News. A strong earthquake struck Nepal early Tuesday afternoon, killing at least 41 people in a country still dealing with a devastating quake that hit less than 3 weeks ago. Nepal's Home Ministry has also reported more than 1,100 people injured. The U.S. Geological Survey said the 7.3 magnitude quake was centered about 80 kilometers east of the capital, Kathmandu. Six strong aftershocks were reported shortly after the quake, with tremors being felt in India, where at least four were killed, and Tibet, where one death was reported. Sudarshan Shrita from the International Aid Group Save the Children told VOA he was inside a hospital in Kathmandu at the time of the earthquake, and that while the building did not seem to be damaged, he later saw others nearby that collapsed. We'll get back to that story in just a minute. He said Save the Children's resources were already stretched after the April 21st earthquake that killed more than 8,000 people and left thousands homeless. The epicenter Tuesday was about 100 kilometers from the center of the earlier quake. Warring sides in Yemen are due to put down their arms late Tuesday and begin observing a five-day ceasefire in order to allow badly needed humanitarian aid to reach civilians inside the conflict-battered country. Houthi rebels, government forces, and the Saudi-led coalition that has been conducting airstrikes for the past 6 weeks in Yemen have all pledged to observe the truce, but there was no guarantee it would take hold, with heavy fighting continuing through Monday. Ahead of the ceasefire deadline, UN humanitarian chief Valerie Amos pleaded with all parties to halt the violence and let aid workers deliver food, provide medical care, ensure access to clean water, and allow people to escape to safer areas. The UN says the fighting in Yemen has killed more than 1,400 people. The United Nations has made an appeal to governments in Southeast Asia to increase search and rescue efforts for thousands of migrants and refugees believed to be stranded on smugglers' boats between the Andaman Sea and the Straits of Malacca. On Monday, Indonesia's navy intercepted another boat full of migrants and refugees from Myanmar and Bangladesh off the coast of North Aceh. A navy spokesman said they provided food, water, and medical supplies to those on board before sending them on their way. And a new survey of religious life in the United States shows that the Christian share of the country's population is declining, while the number of adults who do not identify with any organized religion is growing. That's the news from The Voice of America. I'm Bob Doty.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Swuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
This week, Europe will debate setting up a quota system for allocating among EU member states the hundreds of thousands of refugees arriving on the continent. The discussion comes as Amnesty International warns that brutal treatment of migrants in Libya, including beating, torture and rape, is driving many to escape across the Mediterranean.
That's VOA's Henry Ridgewell reporting from London. Details coming up.
Also in the news, police in Bujumbura fired tear gas today at stone-throwing protesters demonstrating against Burundi President Pierre Nkurunziza's decision to run for a third term.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Nigeria, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, police in Bujumbura fired tear gas today at stone-throwing protesters. They were demonstrating once more against Burundi President Pierre Nkurunziza's decision to run for a third term. One eyewitness claims police fired live rounds of ammunition. No deaths have been confirmed, but witnesses say a woman was shot dead in one suburban skirmish and that a hand grenade killed two in another area of the capital. If the reports are confirmed, the death toll in 2 weeks of unrest would reach 22. Also today, a policewoman accused of shooting into a crowd was badly beaten by her accusers. Mr. Nkurunziza says he will attend a meeting of regional leaders in Dar es Salaam tomorrow to discuss the political crisis. The president blames the unrest on outside forces. The United States has opposed his re-election bid on constitutional grounds. Other donor countries have requested he postpone the election. Several European governments are withdrawing foreign aid related to the June election and Burundi's national security.
The security chief of the European Union says EU members may take action as early as this week against illegal smugglers of migrants to Europe. Even before a draft of anti-smuggling measures is voted on by the EU, its top diplomat, Federica Mogherini, says they are prepared to take action against human trafficking. She does not describe the measures, but says it does not include bombing of boats. Mogherini flew recently to Beijing to seek assurance that China and Russia support the actions. Russia had opposed destroying smugglers' vessels. Mogherini expressed confidence the UN Security Council shared the twin goals of saving lives and combating traffickers. UN official Peter Sutherland says about half of those who have migrated to Europe so far this year qualify as refugees.
This week, Europe will debate setting up a quota system for allocating among EU member states the hundreds of thousands of refugees arriving on the continent. The discussion comes as Amnesty International warns that brutal treatment of migrants in Libya, including beating, torture and rape, is driving many to escape across the Mediterranean. Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
As Europe's politicians continue to debate immigration, the boats keep on coming. At Reggio Calabria in southern Italy, more than 400 migrants were brought ashore by German naval vessels. Germany is also bearing the greatest burden of refugees. Over 400,000 asylum seekers are expected to arrive in the country this year, double last year's total. It prompted German Chancellor Angela Merkel to hold an emergency summit Friday, in which she called for European partners to share responsibility. She said there will be no alternative to European solidarity to get a solution. Hundreds of refugees pass through Italy's Milan station en route to Germany every week. Volunteer aid worker Susie Iovieno offers them food, clothing and advice. She says Europe must make reforms.
Innanzitutto il canale umanitario.
She said this is needed to create a humanitarian corridor, give the possibility to these people to apply for an entry visa legally at the different embassies in the neighboring countries like Lebanon, Jordan and Turkey. That would help avoid the illegal transport and risky trips to Europe, she said. Europe will debate such proposals Wednesday, including a quota system for accepting asylum seekers across member states. Hungary, which is on the route for migrants coming from the Balkans, is one of several nations to have already rejected quotas. Prime Minister Viktor Orbán gave this blunt response.
Azt gondolom, hogy a mi közösségünk nem akar bevándorlókat látni Magyarországon.
We don't want to see immigrants in Hungary, he said. If other EU members ask our opinion, I say to them that I think you should not want to either. Many European states blame the chaos in Libya for the influx of boats and have called for warships along the Libyan coast. But that idea is rejected by the interim prime minister of the government set up by militias controlling Tripoli, one of two rival administrations for the country. Khalifa Al-Gweil said, what we want from the European Union is to deal directly with the National Salvation Government in Tripoli and cooperate with it and provide it with the capabilities to curb the migration. Human rights group Amnesty International says the migrants are subjected to horrendous conditions in Libya, which is driving many to escape across the Mediterranean. Magdalena Mugrabi Talhami is from Amnesty.
They face labor exploitation when they're forced to work for without any pay. They face indefinite detention for migration purposes. Inside those detention centers, they do face widespread torture and other ill treatment, including beatings with sticks, whips, cables.
Meanwhile, Italian divers have located the sunken boat in which more than 700 people are thought to have drowned last month off Libya. Many bodies are still trapped inside. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
At the end of a week's deliberations, 600 delegates from the Central African Republic reached a historic agreement at the Bangui Forum. Known as the Republican Pact, the CAR government and nine of the country's armed opposition groups, who also participated in the forum, reached a groundbreaking accord yesterday on disarmament, demobilization, and reintegration of the armed group's forces. Freddie Nkurikiye is the CAR country representative for the Center for Humanitarian Dialogue, a private diplomacy organization that has been helping CAR's national reconciliation process. He spoke with me about the significance of the accord.
The pact is summarizing the strongest commitment the participants took during the forum about the priorities in terms of needs of reconciliation, reconstruction on some key subjects like governance, justice and reconciliation, peace and security, as well as economic and social development. So there was around 600 participants during 1 week, and there were a lot of recommendations at the end of the forum. But the pact, the added value of the pact, is to summarize the key recommendations as priority for the next step to strengthen the peace and reconciliation process. That's the main thing we have to understand behind the pact.
Was this pact something that was expected to come out of the Bangui Forum?
Yes, I think it is one of the best outcomes of the forum. Because, you know, it's not the first forum held in Bangui. The last was in 2008. At the end of that forum, the all-inclusive political dialogue in 2008, there were more than 100 recommendations, but no priority. How to prioritize? It was not defined. So through the pact, we have those priorities from the Central African Republic people, what they want in the future on the short, middle, and long term. We have some visibility on their needs and how they see what is now the most urgent priority for them.
Who is going to ensure that these commitments be kept?
There was a group, a structure. It will be set up by the President Samba Panza, the transitional president, to follow up how all those recommendations are implemented. so we have to wait for some days. But I think it will be the best thing we can wait for that is to get a mechanism, a follow-up mechanism, which will be efficient and realistic to ensure that it's not just a structure, a bureaucratic structure, to follow up the implementation of the recommendations. That remains also a challenge to complete the success of this forum.
How do civilians feel about this new agreement, considering they have really felt the brunt of all the conflicts and violence that have taken place?
What we have to welcome and support this commitment for peace from armed groups. As you know, in a peace process, once you sign an agreement, the implementation needs some days, some weeks to be effective. Instead of criticize what has been done, et cetera, the main thing is to support it and to ask to all the international community, as well as Central African Republic actors, to support that agreement and to reinforce it and be sure it is the last agreement and we have all to be around it to ensure its success. I think that is the main message we have to convey on that.
When will discussions start concerning prioritizing the agreements?
It depends on the transitional authority agenda, but I think it will be very, very soon, as everybody is mobilized on that. There is some key meetings scheduled on the peace process in TAR, so I think it will be very soon to see how things can be implemented, especially on the peace agreement signed 2 days ago.
Freddie Nkurikiye is the CAR country representative for the Center for Humanitarian Dialogue. He spoke with me from Bangui. You're listening to African News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib, 17 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Police in Bujumbura fired tear gas today at stone-throwing protesters demonstrating against the Burundi president Pierre Nkurunziza's decision to run for a third term. And the security chief of the European Union says EU members may take action as early as this week against illegal smugglers of migrants to Europe. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at African News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
Experts at a high-level World Health Organization meeting have agreed on a roadmap for accelerating research and development into new medical products to fight Ebola and other epidemic-prone diseases. Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
More than 11,000 people in West Africa lost their lives to Ebola because there were no medical preparations to combat this deadly disease. Scientists, industry representatives, and public health officials attending this two-day WHO meeting agreed the situation cannot be allowed to continue. WHO Assistant Director General Marie-Paul Kini says Ebola is not unique in this regard. She says the world was totally unprepared to deal with epidemics of SARS or severe acute respiratory syndrome and the H1N1 bird flu. To remedy this, she says participants are working on a new framework to speed up research and development for diseases that could become epidemics and other health threats. This way, she says, the next time the world is faced with an epidemic, it can respond more quickly and effectively.
If something like Ebola ever happens again to this level, the world needs to be ready with a blueprint, an R&D preparedness plan with clear rules, platform for information sharing, established processes to expedite development and clinical trials, to activate coordinated action and limit the damage.
Dr. Keeney says for certain diseases, the development of medical products should be started before a potential outbreak. She says the speed with which new tools for Ebola were developed and clinical trials for vaccines and drugs were set up shows the world can react more quickly than in the past to combat spreading diseases.
We now have commercial diagnostics to detect Ebola and at least two possibly effective vaccines. I say possibly because for the time being we have no proof that they are efficacious indeed. These results should normally have taken 5 to 10 years if you start the time from where we were in August in 2014. And all this was done in less than 10 months. So what is emerging is an interesting model for R&D that reaches far beyond this particular epidemic and disease. It's not only about Ebola.
But Dr. Keeney notes the window of opportunity for testing is closing. As Ebola wanes, she notes there may not be enough cases to continue testing the vaccines and several candidate drugs. On Saturday, the WHO declared Liberia Ebola-free, and latest reports show just 7 confirmed cases of Ebola in Guinea and 2 in Sierra Leone. Keeney considers this move toward 0 cases in Ebola-ravaged West Africa extremely good news. She says testing can go on in other ways. For example, she says the USDA, the United States Department of Agriculture, has a pathway called Animal Rule, which uses 2 animal models for judging the safety and efficacy of Ebola medications in humans. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Liberia was declared Ebola-free on Saturday after more than a year of battling the outbreak. Nevertheless, much remains to be done to keep the country free of the disease and to strengthen the healthcare system. Dr. Alex Gasasira is the World Health Organization country representative for Liberia. From Monrovia, he spoke to VOA's Jody Kapowa about the main objective now that Liberia has been declared Ebola-free.
The main objective, one, is to ensure that Liberia remains Ebola-free now that transmission has been stopped in the country, and two, to ensure that Liberia does not suffer any other outbreak of such a devastating nature again. So lessons being learned from this outbreak, strengthen the health system, the public health system, and infrastructure in the country to ensure that any other disease, or if Ebola were to come back to the region, it would be detected in a much more timely manner, an adequate and timely response processes set up so that the number of cases can be much, much reduced and we do not see such a devastating outbreak again.
So how do you keep Liberia Ebola-free?
In terms of ensuring that Liberia remains Ebola-free, as you do know, Ebola continues to be reported in Sierra Leone and Guinea. Both countries share borders with Liberia. There's a lot of cross-border population movements because of family, cultural, and economic reasons. And so the government of Liberia and its health partners, including the World Health Organization, are strengthening surveillance at the border areas so that if anybody comes from the borders who may have signs or symptoms that may suggest he or she may have Ebola, this person can be isolated, can be investigated, and indeed, if he or she has Ebola, can be confirmed within the shortest time possible and treated in a way that would prevent this infection from spreading to other people in the community. Similarly, people who are crossing from Liberia into the other countries are being given adequate information, what to do, how to protect themselves. At the borders is continued provision of water and soap and urging people to keep hygiene. Of course, even that is not only at the borders. Even though Liberia has been declared Ebola-free, every effort is being made to keep the communities and population aware that there's still risk of Ebola in the sub-region, and to continue the good practices like hand washing, safe handling of borders that helped stop Ebola in Liberia.
Now, as you know, Liberia was one of the countries that had a weak healthcare system prior to the Ebola epidemic. What do you think it will take to bring that health system up to modern standards so you feel confident it will be able to stop any possible future Ebola threat?
That's an excellent question. The Liberian government, together with all her health partners, including the World Health Organization, recently sat down to look at what lessons did this Ebola outbreak teach all of us. The weak health systems were very, very much exposed, and based on the lessons that we learned and the experience of the outbreak, we developed a plan that aims to address the weaknesses that Ebola exposed in the health system, and not only address these weaknesses, but build a system that's stronger than what existed pre-Ebola. So in terms of disease surveillance, in terms of strengthening laboratory capacity in the country such that any disease or outbreak potential can be confirmed in the country within the shortest time possible. The plan also highlights what it will take to keep the health workers motivated, trained, and available at different parts of the country, as well as just strengthening the infrastructure. Some of the health facilities did not have the requisite infrastructure to prevent transmission from patients to patients or from patients to health workers or vice versa. So all these have been compiled, prioritized, and put into an investment plan for a more resilient health system in the country. And this plan has been disseminated and discussed at many international fora, and is already a positive response from many international partners.
Doctor, is there any idea how much this would cost?
The plan is a seven-year plan. It covers a seven-year period. And for the 7 years, it is estimated at just over $1 billion. When we look at the per capita expenditure, this is not something that's very, very outrageous. This is in line with the recommendations of the expectations of a country the size of Liberia.
It sounds like this is a plan that every African country should have.
That is correct.
Dr. Alex Gasasira is the World Health Organization country representative for Liberia. From Monrovia, he spoke to VOA's Jody Kapua.
Chad's president says poor military cooperation has slowed the regional military campaign against Boko Haram in Nigeria. Idris Deby met yesterday with outgoing Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan and later with President-elect Muhammadu Buhari. In a press conference later, the meeting, Mr. Deby said if Nigeria had cooperated with Chad, the war against Boko Haram would be over by now. Mr. Deby also said they are discussing creation of a rapid response unit with AU authorization. Chad has been critical of Nigerian military efforts over recent months as military forces from Niger, Cameroon, and Chad battled the Nigerian militants.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, political satire from the African diaspora, poking fun at political and religious figures and symbols can make you laugh, but it can also stir up a great deal of controversy. Straight Talk Africa comes to you on Wednesday at 18:30 UTC. Join the discussion. That's next time on VOA Africa.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Police in Bujumbura fired tear gas today at stone-throwing protesters demonstrating against Burundi President Pierre Nkurunziza's decision to run for a third term. And the security chief of the EU says EU members may take action as early as this week against illegal smugglers of migrants to Europe. Coming up, we'll have music from Nigeria and in our feature segment, Ebola-free Liberia's post-recovery plan to restart economic growth. I'm Kim Lewis with Yahya Suhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. It's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Tuesday, Sunny.
Happy Tuesday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you're kicking off with European football.
Kim, let's kick off with the UEFA Champions League football. Bayern Munich is hosting Barcelona this evening in the decisive second leg of a semifinal series. A capacity crowd of 70,000 at the Allianz Arena in Munich. We'll see if the German club can rally from a 3-0 first-leg deficit. Barca's midfield maestro Lionel Messi was magnificent in that match last week. He scored goals in the 77th and 80th minutes and then set up Brazilian star Neymar for the third goal at the end of the game. With a 3-0 advantage, you wouldn't be wrong to think the Spanish club might park the bus in front of goal and play conservatively. But Barca's defensive midfielder, Javier Mascherano from Argentina, told reporters the club will play attacking football.
We're going to play attacking because we don't know how to play in other way. We were playing all the season attacking, trying to win the games. And this is the philosophy of this team, of this club. We will try it. Obviously, we have a good difference, but always trying to find the other goal. Always.
Meanwhile, the other UEFA Champions League semifinal will be played Wednesday in Spain. Defending champion Real Madrid, bidding for a record-extending 11th European title, will try to overturn a 2-1 first-leg deficit against visiting Juventus of Italy. The 24-year-old Belgian Eden Hazard was named England's Footballer of the Year on Tuesday after his consistently outstanding performances throughout the season helped Chelsea win the Premier League title. Tottenham Hotspur striker Harry Kane was second in the voting by members of the English Football Writers Association, and Hazard's Chelsea teammate and captain John Terry was third. Hazard adds this trophy to the Professional Footballers Association prize he won last month, which was awarded by his peers. How do you feel, Eden?
I'm very happy. One day I want to be the best. And this is what I did this season. I play very well. Chelsea play very well. And I don't know if I deserve to win, but it's good for me.
Eden Hazard has started all 36 matches Chelsea has played so far in the Premier League and scored 14 goals. Now let's go to Nigeria, where billionaire Aliko Dangote, described as Africa's richest man, recently made headlines when he said he hopes to buy top English football club Arsenal one day. But some critics are challenging Dangote's interest in the Gunners of Arsenal and are urging him to turn his attention to improving Nigeria's domestic football league. My friend Toyin Ibitoye is the presenter on the Sports Tonight show on VOA partner Channels Television in Nigeria. Toyin believes Dangote's wealth and management experience could be a big boost to Nigerian football.
Maybe it's the right business decision for him. That's left for him to decide. But we can only appeal to him that while planning and strategizing on what he wants to do in terms of buying Arsenal in the future, he could also look inwards as well to help develop our domestic game to the level where the English Premier League is at the moment. I mean, what we've lacked in Nigeria is a proper business structure for our clubs, a proper business plan for our clubs. And if a man of Aligo's caliber is interested in setting a structure in place for Nigerian football, that could just be the turnaround that we've been waiting for.
Toyin Ibitoye says if billionaire Aliko Dangote were to put some of his money into Nigerian football, he could encourage other wealthy investors to follow suit.
We know that Nigeria at the moment, we have a lot of challenges, infrastructural challenges, power, no power. A lot of these challenges are here in Nigeria, but it has not stopped Aliko Dangote from making a success of his cement business, of his sugar business, of his other businesses that he's doing. Because what it does is that it creates a conducive environment around these businesses that will make them thrive. The same thing can happen in our sports, in our football. The environment may not be perfect at the moment, but somebody like Aliko Dangote coming in, setting a structure around his own interest in football, can begin to draw a roadmap that other billionaires, other money bags can follow to have a proper structure for club football in Nigeria and, of course, for sports in general.
And speaking of sports in general, Toyin Ibitoye likes to bring me on Channels TV's Sports Tonight show on Thursday evenings for sporty updates. So if you can tune in Sports Tonight in Nigeria, look for me to drop in on Thursday evenings.
Friends, we can all listen to the sunny side of sports.
Yes, my friend.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help us every day. It will brighten all the way. It will keep on the sunny side of life.
Voice of America.
I'm Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the sunny side of sports on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
Joining us now with more sports news is the VOA's Daybreak Africa sportsman, Mark Ouma.
We begin with golf. Defending champions South Africa clinched their 17th successive victory at the All Africa Junior Golf Championships in Lusaka, Zambia on Sunday. Zimbabwe was second and Zambia third. They were followed by Kenya, Swaziland, Uganda, Tunisia, Namibia, Botswana, while Mauritius were placed 10th. Turning to athletics, Kenyan Stephen Sambu clocked a lifetime best of 27 minutes and 30 seconds to win the Great Manchester 10-kilometer run in Britain on Sunday. South African Stephen Mokoka was runner-up in a career best time of 27 minutes and 38 seconds. Mokoka also betters the South Africa 10-kilometer record from 27 minutes and 50 seconds held by Shadrach Hoff since 2002. Kenyan Bernard Lagat was third in 27 minutes and 48 seconds. The trio are the world's fastest runners in 10 kilometers this year. Meanwhile, Kenyan Betsy Saina won the women's race in 31 minutes and 49 seconds. Britain's Gemma Steele was 6 seconds behind, while Kenyan Edna Kiplagat was third in 31 minutes and 57 seconds. In football, despite hosts Kenya beating Botswana 4-1 in the return leg of the Africa Under-23 Championship qualifier in Nairobi on Saturday, Botswana progressed to the second round on the away goal rule after they drew 4-all on aggregate. In Djibouti, Rwanda held their hosts Somalia to a 1-all draw to progress on a 3-1 aggregate. Meanwhile, hosts Zambia beat Malawi 2-0 in a friendly played in Lusaka on Saturday. In rugby, South Africa edged hosts Scotland 12-10 in the plate final at the IRB 7 series in Glasgow, Scotland on Sunday, while Argentina beat Kenya 24-7 in the ball semi-final. At the end of the penultimate leg of this year's IRB 7 series, South Africa dropped to second place in the overall standings with 142 points. Kenya is 13th with 38 points, while Zimbabwe is 20th with 1 point. Finally, in cycling, 22-year-old James Reid led Matthew Bilkes, rookie Crossier, Brendan Davis and Philip Byers in a 1-2-3-4-5 South African sweep at the Africa Mountain Bike Continental Championships in Musanze, Rwanda on Sunday. Mauritius is second and Rwanda third. The contest is a qualifier for the 2016 Rio de Janeiro Olympics.
This is the voice of America. Washington, Bob, D.C.
They're playing basketball. We love that basketball.
The National Basketball Association playoffs continue later Tuesday night with two games. In the first game of the evening, the Cleveland Cavaliers host the Chicago Bulls in Game 5 of the Eastern Conference semifinals. The best-of-seven series is tied at two games each. And that will be followed by a game between the Houston Rockets and the Los Angeles Clippers. The Clippers lead this Western Conference semifinal series 3-1, and they'll advance with a victory tonight. In results Monday night, the Atlanta Hawks soared past the Washington Wizards here in Washington, 106-101, to even the Eastern Conference semifinal series at 2 games each. The Hawks got solid contributions from 3 of their all-star players, Jeff Teague, Al Horford, and Paul Millsap. Teague tallied a team-high 26 points with 8 assists, while Horford and Millsap scored 18 and 19 points, respectively. Bradley Beal led the Wizards with a game-high 34 points. Game 5 is Wednesday evening in Atlanta, Georgia. In the southern U.S. city of Memphis, Tennessee, the Golden State Warriors routed the host Memphis Grizzlies 101-84 to even that series at 2 games each. League most valuable player Stephen Curry scored a game-high 33 points for the Warriors, who will host Game 5 Wednesday evening in Oakland, California. Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOASunny, and my Twitter handle is at VOA Sunny Sports. I'm VOA Sunny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to you, Hayes Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sunny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, Ebola-free Liberia's post-recovery plan to restart economic growth. And next, Zimbabwe's education sector being affected by financial constraints. But first, some music. Here is P Square of Nigeria with Ifunaya.
Fall in love, it could be for the game or pleasure, I don't know, but when it comes to lust, yeah, that's for sure, but when I can't throw these things around, girl, now you, you're the one that makes me smile and it's true. Ooh, yeah, now only you,
Square of Nigeria with Ifunanya.
Well, the Liberian government says now that the country is Ebola-free, it has a post-recovery plan in hand to restart the economic growth. Government ministers say they are optimistic about the country's future as it emerges from the deadly Ebola epidemic, which has claimed more than 4,600 lives. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Liberia's Minister of Commerce and Industry, Axel Addy, says Liberia has had no new cases of Ebola for a while, and the country is approaching the finish line to be determined Ebola-free.
So May 9th is our magic date. If there are no new cases, and I believe there will be no new cases, we would have met the threshold. Some of the Ebola treatment centers actually have been decommissioned, and there are others being decommissioned.
Addy tells VOA the government knows Ebola could recur and is putting in place a management system to deal with another emergency should it arise.
It includes putting in place the right health infrastructure to deal with the response, to track any sort of new potential cases, and to monitor what's happening along the borders.
Besides strengthening its health system and protecting its people from the possibility of a new outbreak of this deadly disease, Liberia is faced with a huge task of reviving its economy. Before Ebola struck, Liberia was projecting a GDP growth rate for 2014 of between 5.9 and 7%. After the crisis hit, Liberia's gross domestic product dipped to below 1%. Liberian Minister of State without Portfolio, Augustine Jarrett, says the Ebola crisis has had a cascading effect on all aspects of the economy, especially on Liberia's two main products, rubber and iron ore. He says companies closed, thousands of people lost their jobs, and farms became idle, stripping thousands of farmers of their income. He says it is clear that Liberia cannot remain dependent on two products, but must diversify into other areas. He says Liberia plans to put more emphasis in the future on working with the private sector as opposed to the government side.
Most of what we've seen in many, many decades before is that most of the people who work in Liberia work in the government sector, and that's going to change because our focus is on private sector jobs, private sector investments, and trying to move the economy in the direction where private sector players are the drivers of our economic growth and vitality.
The Liberian ministers say they are working hard to attract private investment to help build up infrastructure and to get major road, bridge, and other construction projects that had stopped during the Ebola epidemic back online. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
When Zimbabwe schools opened recently, students and teachers were bemoaning the worsening state of the economy, which they said continues to negatively affect the education sector. Parents are struggling to raise school fees, while teachers wanted the government to improve their salaries and working conditions. Reporter Tatenda Ngumbo spoke with Judith Chiangwa of Girls Legacy, who explains how the education sector is being affected by financial constraints.
We don't have the parents having a source of income, a constant source of income where they're able to afford to send their people to school. What this then does, especially to the girl child, is that if there's no money that is going to be found for her to go to school, there's nothing else that she's able to do, especially when she's home. One of the things that most of the families are now forcing their children to be married, and child marriages are on the increase because that's another form of income that is sort of come up from the less privileged families so that they're able to afford, you know, basic food, basic living, because they are not able to afford it all. You also realize with the boys especially, there's a high increase of drug abuse because there's nothing else to do.
Realistically, in your view, what can be done to make sure that at this level, our young schoolers are able to at least have an adequate education in Zimbabwe?
Your question, I would respond it from a very broader perspective. Where we are looking at Zimbabwe as a country with so many resources, it is a country that is able to sustain itself if the resources are managed well. I know right now there's a lot of talk about minerals, diamonds, a lot of mines coming up. There's a lot of expatriates owning or part owning some of the mines. The question therefore that comes is then to say, why is it that government is not focusing on the exploitation of its own resources so that it feeds back to its own people?
That was Judith Chiangwa of Girls Legacy. She was speaking with reporter Tatenda Gumbo. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
In another sign of the United States' determination to help the nations of Africa combat terrorism, millions of dollars in rewards are being offered for information on several top leaders of the Al-Qaeda-linked Somalia-based terrorist organization Harakat Shabab al-Mujahideen, or Al-Shabaab. The group, listed as a foreign terrorist organization since 2008, is battling that nation's government for control of Somalia and has also carried out a string of attacks in Kenya, most recently at a college in the town of Garissa. It is responsible for the deaths of thousands of Somali civilians, peace activists, international aid workers, journalists, and civilians, as well as African Union peacekeepers who are helping to restore stability and prosperity to the region. Tens of thousands of people have been forced to flee their homes amid the fighting. Under the terrorist designation, the United States imposed financial and other restrictions on the group, blocking property and prohibiting U.S. persons from engaging in transactions with its members. Now the U.S. is offering rewards for information leading to the location of six of its leaders. Rewards of up to $5 million each are offered for information on the location of Ibrahim Haji Jama, also known as Abu Zalma, Fuad Mohammed Khalaf, a dual Somali and Swedish national, also known as Fuad Shungala, Bashir Mohammed Mahmoud, an al-Shabaab military commander believed to have been born between 1979 and 1982, and Mukhtar Robo, a 43-year-old who has served as an al-Shabaab spokesman and who carries an Eritrean passport. Rewards of up to $3 million each are offered for information on the location of two additional al-Shabaab leaders, Abdullahi Yare and the group's intelligence chief, Zakaria Ismail Ahmed Hersi, also known as Zaki Madobi. The United States guarantees all credible reports will be investigated, and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the U.S. is prepared to protect informants by relocating them. If you have information on any of these men, contact the Regional Security Office at the nearest U.S. Embassy and the tip line at www.rewardsforjustice.net or email information to rfj@state.gov.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.
Hello, I'm Lenor Mudu. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, political satire from the African diaspora, poking fun at political and religious figures and symbols can make you laugh, but it can also stir up a great deal of controversy. Straight Talk Africa comes to you on Wednesday at 18:30 UTC. Join the discussion. That's next time on VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. This is James Butte, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.